GTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. 10 past 8, the morning show with Greg Berg is next.
Welcome you to the Friday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. I have been absolutely devouring a brand new novel called A House Full of Windsor. And it's written by a very talented writer by the name of Kristen Contino, who is chief reporter at Royal Central, and someone who speaks extensively about the royal family. Her debut novel was called The Legacy of Us. A House Full of Windsor is her second novel. And in it, we meet a really fascinating family, including a mother who cannot let go of her past and a somewhat traumatic divorce, which has prompted her to live a life that is ultimately consumed by hoarding. And hoarding is one of those things that we hear about. We sometimes glance at television programs about it, but that doesn't mean that we're necessarily on the inside understanding just what a hoarder is experiencing, what drives them into that situation. Kristen Contino in this book has really done an amazing job of kind of putting us in the footsteps of at least one woman who finds herself in that position, and her three children who find themselves powerfully affected by this, and the potential then of her going on, that is the woman, going on one of those so-called hoarding shows for the possibility of getting help and kind of turning her life around. But what does it mean to allow that kind of attention into one's life, and especially when something is as potentially embarrassing as this? It's a novel that is full of all kinds of rich emotional authenticity, just beautifully written and crafted. It's published by Wyatt McKenzie. Again, it is titled A House Full of Windsor. And Kristen Contino, we welcome you to the morning show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Before we talk about your novel, which, again, I have so enjoyed reading, I wonder if we could talk just a little bit about the work that you do as chief reporter at Royal Central. First of all, help us understand what Royal Central is and the kind of work that you do.
So Royal Central is the number one online source for news about royal families from around the world. So we not only cover the British royal family, but in Europe and Asia, Africa, all different royal families from around the world. And I specifically write about the British royal family, but it's very fascinating just to learn more about different, you know, monarchies around, you know, different countries that you might not be familiar with. So that's something that I personally have enjoyed writing for the site. But I often speak, you know, to news media, the BBC, et cetera, about, you know, breaking royal news. And I was there when Harry and Meghan got married, which was really exciting. So it's a lot of fun.
So you're not British yourself?
Or you I'm American. My ancestry is British, but I have lived here, other than living in London for college for a bit, my entire life.
Wow. So help us understand what it's like to be an American taken up professionally in matters related to Britain and the royal family and so on. And what kind of perspective do you bring to the matters that you cover?
I think as an American, it's interesting because it's something we don't have here. So I think there's an automatic kind of fascination for some people in that sense, just because it's interesting, glamorous, you know, fairy tale, if you will. I think people have that idea. But when you really are getting into, you know, these matters of the day-to-day charity work and all the things that are involved with the job, you learn it's so much more than that. So I think it's an interesting perspective just because, well, one, I'm not paying for them as a taxpayer. So I have that added, you know, kind of detachment, if you will. But I, you know, I grew up, and I think a lot of people my age grew up with Princess Diana, you know, in the background, and maybe our parents, my mother, for example, she loved Princess Diana. So I had that growing up in the 80s and 90s, and William and Harry are around my age. So I feel as if I grew up with them. We went through similar milestones at the same time, getting married, having kids. You know, my son is the same age as George. So you feel kind of a personal connection to them almost. And I hear that a lot from, you know, other people, not even royal watchers, but just, you know, people in America, that they feel like they know them.
And I'm curious, in the work that you have done, and I mean, you're not a particularly old person. You haven't been doing this for decades upon decades upon decades. But in the time that you have been doing this, do you sense any kind of significant shift in terms of the British public and its attitude about the royal family, or maybe the standing of the royal family? And maybe that's an overly simplistic question, since when we talk about the royal family, we are not just talking about the Queen or your particular children or grandchildren and so on. It's a complicated family, just like most families are. But at least in general, what would you say the current state of affairs are in terms of the royal family and the British public?
So I think, and like you said, it's multifaceted and kind of complicated, but I think right now the Queen has been so popular, especially during the pandemic, her reaching out to the public and giving messages of hope and strength, and people have really looked to her for comfort in this time, and just different members of the royal family doing Zoom engagements and being kind of more accessible has almost helped build their popularity, even though people are staying home, because they've been able to reach out to more people than before. So I think we will kind of see that continue with them, you know, being more accessible and out there, even if it's, you know, video calling people. And I think the British public has appreciated that, that they're, you know, going out and thanking NHS workers, their healthcare system, and going out and, you know, thanking people for their work in the pandemic and really getting into the local communities. So that certainly has helped. In a greater sense, it's, you know, there's always the Harry and Meghan issue, which, you know, we could have an entire hour talking about that. And they're really not very popular with the British public at the moment. But, you know, the Queen and other members certainly, you know, have been popular. Whether, you know, when Prince Charles eventually does come to the throne, there's the question of how things will shift and change. So that's definitely an interesting, you know, thing to keep an eye on.
By the way, what is the current state of affairs in England regarding COVID? To what extent is it still a dark shadow of hanging over everything, or does it feel like you are finally emerging into a better day?
Things are getting better for sure. And, you know, versus in America where things have been open and everyone kind of going about normal business for some time for the most part, it's a little bit slower there. So they are just starting to lift restrictions this month fully is when they're supposed to. And that's coming up very soon. But a lot of my friends, you know, they couldn't go to hair salons until pretty recently and that sort of thing, whereas here, you know, you feel like everything's open. So I think that's been difficult for a lot of people. But, you know, the royal family has been able to get out now in person and do these things like, you know, go to hospitals and visit people and that sort of thing, where before they were, you know, restricted to being at home and doing video.
Hmm. Your biography says that London is your favorite city in the world. So it sounds like it's not the home where you make your, it's not the city where you make your home, but it is your favorite city. Just say a word about why you think of London in those terms.
So when I was in college, I studied abroad in London, much like Debbie in A House Full of Windsor. Actually, I have her study at the same university, just that's my little shout out to them. But I fell in love with London when I moved there and, you know, really had hoped to go back and live there again, which hasn't happened yet, but we'll see. I just feel like there's such an energy and the history and culture there that you can't compare to anywhere else. It just has a special feeling.
We're speaking with Kristen Contino about her book, A House Full of Windsor. This is a novel, and at the heart of it is a mother and a daughter and a very difficult, complicated relationship and a very, very challenging situation that really confronts both of them. First of all, one of the things I appreciate about the novel is the clarity in which you shift back and forth between in perspective between the mother, Debbie, and the daughter, Sarah, chapter by chapter. So one chapter we are experiencing things from the perspective of the mother, and then in the next chapter through the perspective of the daughter, Sarah. I really like that. I think it really works well. I'm just curious what drew you to that particular framework in terms of shaping the novel.
Thank you. So I guess to go back to the beginning, I was watching an episode of the TV show Hoarders one weekend, and there was a mother and daughter on this episode. The daughter was talking about how her life had been really impacted by her mother's hoarding, and I thought, okay, that's an interesting thing to explore in fiction. I had just finished working, you know, on The Legacy of Us, my first novel, and I was kind of throwing out some ideas, you know, in my head for another book, but I didn't really have anything concrete. And when I watched this episode, the light bulb went off. So I thought it would be really interesting to explore mother-daughter relationship in this sense, but I wanted the daughter to be totally opposite from the mother, because I think in a hoarding situation, you know, the child either ends up one of two ways. They end up like their parent, or they want to go, you know, the complete opposite route from, you know, the home they grew up in and really detach themselves from that. So that's what I wanted to do with Sarah. And I really found it so fascinating when I was researching compulsive hoarding and had a few nonfiction books on the topic from psychologists and things like that that I read. And it's crazy to think about if you're growing up in that type of home, how that could impact you, not just in I'm a clean person or I don't want to be like my mom, just everything, the way you handle your relationships, your career. It touches a lot of things.
And so explain to our listeners exactly the way in which the character of Sarah, the oldest daughter of Debbie, to what extent she has built a life that is completely contrary to the life and experience of her mother, who is a hoarder.
So Sarah is a TV host on a show called Good Morning New York, and she has a segment called Sarah Says, where she gives out all kinds of advice, you know, cleaning tips, recipes, etiquette advice, and she kind of fancies herself a bit of a Martha Stewart / Emily Post combo. And Sarah really wants to appear perfect. She wants to act like she has all the answers, and definitely opposite to her mother. She wants to give off, you know, this perfect facade, and she doesn't want anyone to know. I mean, she has a best friend at the station and her producer who know about her mom, but nobody else does. and she doesn't want her audience to know that this is the type of house she grew up in, because she thinks, oh, they'll think I'm a fraud. And she really keeps, you know, boyfriends out and doesn't want anyone to know about her dirty secret that, you know, she grew up in a house like this. So Sarah really struggles with that, that she, you know, she doesn't want to be associated with this mess.
I'm glad you evoked the name Martha Stewart. I mean, in a sense, it would be if we learned that Martha Stewart's mother was a hoarder and you know, living a life completely different from that of her famous daughter. That would be one way to kind of think about the dynamic here. One of the things you've also done is given the character of Debbie more than one child. So it's not just Sarah, but it's also twins, a boy and a girl, who are also part of this family. And it's really interesting to follow the complicated dynamics between these three siblings, which of course makes a challenging situation even more challenging. Describe to our listeners about these other two siblings and the way you shaped their characters.
So Anne and Will are the two younger siblings of Sarah, and they're twins. And Will lives in New York and works in TV, so he ends up getting a producer job on this hoarding reality show. And Anne, his twin, is a stay-at-home mom. She lives in Philadelphia's Main Line area, which is a very upscale area, and she's married to a guy with some money. And we see some parallels between Anne and Debbie in that sense, in that she's, you know, has this nice house and everything, but she is kind of like Sarah, also trying to give off a perfect image. And she's very clean to the point of OCD, and she has a lot of issues with her brother moving to New York, and there's a very much like a sibling rivalry that, you know, her twin has left her and gone to New York, and now he's closer to Sarah, which, you know, they were always the closest. And so there's a weird dynamic between the three of them, almost of jealousy, because the twins have been separated geographically, but also she feels like she's, you know, with these young children, and she's kind of trying to find herself too, Anne.
And it's so interesting to kind of learn about what it's been like for these siblings to grow up around all of this, and for them to, in a sense, grow accustomed to it, and then at some point to find it at some point intolerable. And of course, that's one of the kind of complicated dynamics that is here. We need to talk about the mother and the nature of her hoarding, and a little bit about what is at the root of it. First of all, explain to our listeners what she is hoarding. If we walked into her home, the kind of things we would see.
So, yes, we didn't even get into that yet, but Debbie had, you know, real fascination with Princess Diana. And when we meet her in the book in the 80s, she is studying abroad in London, and she's very excited about the royal wedding, and her soon-to-be husband, who she meets, Alan, they go to the royal wedding and camp out and all of that, and this kind of builds her interest, and she starts collecting magazines and little things, you know, buttons from the wedding here and there. And as she kind of becomes disillusioned with her relationship, she gets pregnant with Sarah unexpectedly. And, you know, she's just casually dating Alan, not expecting anything to happen. She's supposed to fly home to America and graduate, and she ends up staying there with kind of a shotgun wedding because she's pregnant. So she's very, you know, kind of lonely. She doesn't know many people there other than her roommate and her now husband, and she starts collecting more and more and shopping just to kind of pass the time. But she also sees herself as having a kinship with Diana because they both get married at the same time. They both end up, you know, pregnant around the same time. And so she feels like, okay, we're in this together, and, you know, around the same age. And as the years go on, she starts shopping more and collecting more, and her relationship becomes worse and worse, and in part because of the collecting, but also in part just because of circumstances, them being kind of thrown together in a relationship that probably wasn't meant to be. So Debbie really ends up with this house full of Windsor, literally, and she gets a divorce and moves back to America, and the house there just gets completely out of control because she has no one to keep her in check.
Hmm. And although it is not the only reason she and her husband get divorced, a big part of why they ultimately cannot remain together is because of this collection already getting out of control even before she ultimately moves to America.
Yes, and they fight, you know, a lot. And we have, so the book has flashback scenes to the 80s and 90s in the UK and then back and forth to the present day. So we see kind of how their relationship evolves and how the collecting evolves to, you know, where it is now. And Alan, you know, has some other issues that they do end up, you know, fighting about, but it's really, a lot of it is, like, clean up your stuff, you know, why can't you just move it here? Why can't you cut down on the shopping? But the shopping is a result of her unhappiness in the relationship, so it just keeps going and going.
Absolutely. Maybe we could just say a word about Debbie's fascination with Princess Diana and her sense of kinship with her. One has a sense that it isn't just, oh, I'm getting married and she got married, and, you know, that their lives were in parallel in terms of just major events, but also the dynamic of that wedding and the difficulty that Diana was facing in suddenly being part of the royal family. And not that that was Debbie's situation, but in some respects, she was facing a similarly daunting challenge in being part of her husband's family and being part of a life very different from what she'd ever known before.
Yes, that's a good point, because Debbie, you know, she's marrying unexpectedly into this very aristocratic, you know, family. They have a very grand home outside of London in Essex, which is about an hour away. And, you know, they pull up and she's thinking, oh my God, we're not in Kansas anymore. Like, this is, she lives in a typical suburban, you know, Philadelphia home, nothing fancy, very middle-class background. And she's completely caught off guard and not really necessarily welcomed into the family because they're, you know, unhappy that she's pregnant and they've never even met this girl. So I think she relates to Diana in the sense that, you know, she was very young and married into, you know, an imposing family. So they both have that in common. And I think she kind of looks to her for inspiration or strength in that sense.
There's a moment in one of these flashbacks. So this is May of 1981. And she is realizing the sort of life that that Alan has and thinking about the life of her own family back home in America. And at one point she's thinking, I thought of my parents, the rusted porch swing, the dog, a normal house, a normal family. No, it wasn't bad. It was worse. It was boring. So interesting to think about somebody feeling like that the life and the family that they had known and probably felt at least pretty good about suddenly seems drab and normal in comparison to the life of the man that she's suddenly finds herself with. I mean, what a terrible emotional predicament for somebody to find themselves in. I mean, how much better it is when you fall in love with someone who, in a sense, enhances your appreciation for and values who you are and where you come from and help you value it more. That's just the opposite here.
Yes. So, in a sense, I can relate to Debbie there because I think she's really attaching her fun times and kind of expanding her horizon and culture. Living in London, this is the first time she's been out of the country. She's never experienced, you know, this buzzing metropolitan city and being able to travel and things like that. And she's thinking, oh my gosh, like, what if I have to go back home? And suddenly her world, which was normal to her, seems very, very small. So yes, she definitely has had such a change in her circumstance that now she feels like, well, how can I go back to that? And, you know, this seems so terribly boring. And I did feel a bit of the same way when I was in London, because, you know, similar circumstances, you know, growing up in a smaller suburb and never really leaving the United States, and then your experience to this whole world that kind of opens up to you. And then you're like, what? Wait, what? When you go home, it's a kind of a reverse culture shock.
Absolutely. The passage when you describe her first seeing Alan's home is so interesting. She writes, you write, "It wasn't just morning sickness that had my stomach twisted tighter than the Queen's knickers. I'd been nervous enough about Alan's parents' reaction to meeting me, but now that I'd seen where they lived, it was 100 times worse. My parents' one-story house with yellow siding and overgrown grass seemed absurd in comparison, almost like the picture you'd see in a dictionary next to trashy American suburbia. The Percy's home was a legitimate, old-timey English mansion." Our heart goes out to her as she finds herself one half of such an odd couple. And, of course, it is not a big surprise that she finds herself contending with emotional challenges of varying kinds. And one of the chief mechanisms with which she copes with this overwhelming new reality is with shopping, and ultimately with hoarding. Mm-hmm. One of the things that's interesting is when you kind of describe some of the things that she is purchasing that are related to Charles and Diana. And I wonder, first of all, this kind of wild array of items, are these things that actually did exist, that certain people were collecting at the time? Or are these just kind of the product of your own imagination?
Oh, definitely. No, I mean, in terms of royal souvenirs, you could buy almost anything. I mean, your eyebrows would raise if you heard some of the things I've seen in shops at the royal wedding. But yes, I mean, very much the tea towels, the china plates, the dolls. I mean, the list goes on. There's so many, you know, things that you could buy. And I actually, looking in my home office I'm sitting at right now, as a little treat to myself for the publication of the book, I hunted down a Charles and Diana champagne flute from their wedding. It was a souvenir, and I bought myself one.
We're speaking with Kristen Contino. We're talking about her book called A House Full of Windsor. The central character in the book happens to have the last name of Windsor, but is no relation to the royal family. But she feels a strong kinship to Princess Diana and Prince Charles. And during her marriage to an Englishman named Alan, Debbie finds herself accumulating all kinds of items, more and more and more, until suddenly she is a textbook hoarder. And even after the marriage ends and she resettles back to America, the collection goes with her, and with it all of the issues, which become even more difficult after her children are grown up and gone, and her impulses are left, in a sense, unchecked. Kristen, continue. You mentioned that you did some research into the phenomenon of hoarding. And I think it would be interesting if we took a few minutes to just kind of talk about some of what you learned. First of all, we hear so much about this now. But, you know, for instance, when I grew up in the 1960s and 70s, I don't remember this ever being talked about. And certainly there weren't television programs in which you were actually taken into the homes of people who were hoarders. In your research, can you tell us anything about how long this has been an issue? Is this something that's been with us longer than we might realize, but has it just become much more known, much more public in a sense? Or is this more a phenomenon tied to modern life and modern consumerism?
That's an interesting question because, as you say, I mean, with modern consumerism, it's kind of buy more, buy this. But there certainly have been people, you know, look at the early 1900s, who collected things and, you know, had their houses in the state. But I don't think it's really something that was widely discussed or talked about. Certainly the popularity of the show Hoarders has brought it to more of a, you know, national or international attention. I know in the UK they have a similar show. But yes, I mean, there have definitely been people in this condition. I think it just, you know, with media, it's been more widespread, you know, in terms of talking about it. But the research I found just really interesting, especially in terms of how hoarders kind of create like a magical quality to an object. And there's a memory attached to the object. And it's, and you know, as you would see in the book with Debbie, she feels as if, you know, you get rid of this blanket that she sat on at the royal wedding, you know, that it's like it's almost taking part of the memory away from her. And it's really this sense of, you know, attaching memories and things of people to the object. And say if you give away your grandmother's tea set, well, it's like giving away a part of her. So that was something that I found interesting. And I actually have a friend whose mother is a compulsive hoarder. And I spoke to her just, you know, about her experience growing up and, you know, how it made her feel and how she deals with it today. And that helped me, you know, a little bit with the characters of Will and Anne and Sarah, because I mean, I'm not familiar, obviously, growing up in a house like that, but it was certainly handy to know someone who did.
How common is it for hoarding to be so heavily themed as Debbie's is? I mean, her house, at least for the most part, from the way you describe it, is full of royal family memorabilia. That's way out of hand, although maybe she is hoarding certain other items as well. But certainly the bulk of what is filling her room, her house to the point of it nearly exploding, is royal memorabilia. How common is it for a hoarder to be engaged in a sense such specifically focused hoarding?
I think a lot of people who are hoarders just accumulate stuff in general, but there are certainly ones. I know there was a woman who collected dolls, and she had just like porcelain dolls and dolls everywhere. So certainly there are people who get out of hand with a specific thing, but I think the more common, you know, reality would be that there's just all kinds of stuff everywhere. And with my book, I wanted it to be very specific in terms of, you know, something that the person collected. But that was also, for me, kind of a device to make the novel a little more palatable. Because, I mean, no one wants to read a book about someone with rotting cats or, you know, food. You see these episodes of hoarders with, you know, food expired and things like that. I didn't want it to be something like that, but more, you know, something that also was a little bit catchy, because let's face it, with marketing, you know, you need a hook for your book, and the royal family is very popular right now. So I think that helped. But for Debbie, you know, I wanted her to have a laser focus on one thing, that she had to keep collecting this thing, and everything she sees, she feels like she has to get.
Right. And I appreciate the fact also that Debbie is a hoarder who has, on some level, an awareness that there is a problem. And apparently there really are some hoarders who are disturbed to such an extent that they honestly don't understand why anybody else is concerned. And Debbie certainly has those moments where she has at least flashes of realization that indeed her hoarding is terribly out of hand and something needs to happen. And I think that emotional state is a lot more interesting for us as readers than someone who is so detached from reality that none of this is a problem. Does that make sense?
Yes, and I purposely did that just because I didn't want her to seem that unrelatable to the reader, but I certainly wanted her to have some sort of self-awareness, maybe not a huge amount of self-awareness, but some, where she acknowledges, yes, this isn't normal, but she keeps doing it because she kind of can't stop.
Right. At one point when her daughter, Anne, has kind of stomped out, and Debbie is sitting there alone again, she says, Anne said no one wanted to be at my house. And the funny thing is, once they left and I climbed over all of the ridiculous boxes and bags and tunneled my way into the living room, I realized I didn't want to be there either. And a little few moments later, staring at the ceiling, I pictured 20, maybe 30 more years like the night before. And at that, by that point, I wouldn't even be able to lift the boxes off of my bed. So Debbie knows that there is a problem. And, of course, her children are struggling to figure out how to help her. Ultimately, the key, they think, is if Debbie will agree to be a participant in the hoarding show for which her son Will, ironically enough, has become a producer. I wonder if you could tell us what you learned about the kind of hoarding programs that we see on television, what you have learned about the nature of what they do, and to what extent the people they seek to help actually get help. I mean, are helped out of their problem in a meaningful and sustainable way.
I think, you know, aftercare is certainly the key there. And, you know, aftercare is offered to people who are on these shows. But it's like, I don't know if you've ever watched the show Intervention. It can go one of either, you know, way. Either they decide that this is the life they want to lead and they see how clean their house is now and they continue to get therapy and, you know, they're cured, if you will, or they just go right back to doing what they were doing. And obviously you need to want, you know, to change, and that's half the battle. So I think it can be frustrating because they want to help people and they're also at the same time making a show and it's entertainment. So, you know, it's sad when you see that someone, you know, doesn't, you know, end up keeping their house in the way that, you know, it's presented on the show long term. And there have been follow-ups where they show people and, you know, okay, where are they now and that sort of thing. And a lot of them are continuing on doing well, and, you know, maybe just as many aren't.
This particular show host who comes in, Pierce, is his last name Thompson? Do I remember that correctly?
Yes.
He's an interesting character, and I think the way you shape him makes him quite compelling. And, of course, you had a wide array of possibilities in terms of what kind of character this would be who would come into Debbie's home and seem to want to try to help her. Describe to our listeners what Pierce Thompson is like and why you wanted this character to be the kind of character he is.
So Pierce is, and when I was picturing Pierce, you know, that Ty Pennington, who was pretty popular, I guess, you know, about 10, 15 years ago on, he was on the home renovation show, Extreme Home Makeover and that sort of thing. And he was, you know, contractor guy who was really likable and down to earth. And I kind of had him in mind a bit for Pierce, but I wanted him to be this very relatable guy, even though he was on TV and he was pretty famous, that he was just like your average guy who liked to help, you know, help around the house and that sort of thing. But he was very relatable and very friendly. And I actually had him, he was Australian when I first wrote the book. And when I changed, I did some edits. I actually made him Southern because I wanted him to have kind of like that down home, like very casual, relatable tone. So Pierce is the host of Stuff, this hoarding show. And he had a friend when he was a child who, you know, the mother was a hoarder. And that kind of inspired him to help people and, you know, start this show where he could change people's lives and help make over their house and all of that. And he really cares deeply about the people on the show, but I think a lot of them, Debbie, for example, think, well, they're just trying to exploit me. This is entertainment. This is TV. You know, are they really going to help? And so I wanted him to be very compassionate, but also we see throughout the novel that he has a spark with Sarah, which she tries to kind of fight for a while, and we see how that plays out throughout the novel.
One of the things I also really appreciate about the way you've shaped the character of Sarah is that she is in an uncomfortable, rather, let's say, fragile situation with her own job, and she feels quite vulnerable as she asks for a brief time off in order to participate in this program. And the stakes are high for her professionally in terms of, mm-hmm. of the possibility of the public coming to know this about her life and her background. But I especially just found so compelling this picture of somebody in the entertainment business seemingly having it all and yet feeling like it's all tentative and that it could all slip away so easily, especially if she says or does the wrong thing or if the ratings that have been drooping don't start improving. I just wonder... is this something that's been part of your own life, or how did you manage to describe this so vividly and so authentically?
Oh, well, thank you first. And no, I mean, I've never worked in TV or anything like that, but I think it's kind of easy for anyone to put themselves in a situation where you feel like you're trying to keep it all together and there's all these things coming at you from different angles. And it's like, okay, I have to keep my job going and my family relationships and my, you know, romantic relationships and everything kind of coming at you at once. And I think that's how Sarah feels in the book, where she's just really trying to keep it all together. And she does a pretty good job at it, you know, publicly at least. But under the surface, she's, you know, like a duck with her feet paddling really fast and appearing calm above. So that's kind of what I wanted Sarah to have in this book, where she was eventually she can't keep it all together anymore and she can't keep that perfect facade, but also she shouldn't. And kind of her learning to become more vulnerable and admit that she's not perfect is part of her character arc. And I think Pierce helps her along with that. But, yeah, to answer your question, no, I mean, I don't really have that, you know, exact experience per se with, you know, the ratings and things like that. But I think as a novelist, you can relate a little bit to that because you're trying to make sure your book does as well as possible. And what if it doesn't sell well? And, you know, putting yourself out there in the sense that Sarah does is quite difficult in the public eye.
Right. I also appreciate the fact that you have both Sarah and Will in the entertainment business and then their sibling Annie, who is not. And in so many of the comments she makes, it's clear that she views a lot of what is done by her siblings or what they say in a sense with kind of a chip on her shoulder. I mean, she feels mm-hmm. like she is living this ordinary life that they do not necessarily appreciate, and we on the other hand feel for them because we get the sense that they are good people who love their sister and are trying to appreciate her, but it's hard to help somebody who you know views everything kind of through that suspicious kind of lens. It just seems like a really tricky dynamic, and you as the novelist of course are responsible for creating that for us the reader.
Yeah, and I actually wrote another book with Anne as the main character, which may or may not ever see the light of day because it needs quite a bit of work. But at the time I was writing Houseful of Windsor, it, you know, was being pitched to different publishers and whatnot, and it seemed like it probably wasn't going to happen. This was actually in 2016, and I decided I was going to put it away and write another book, and I wrote a book from Anne's point of view. And even though, you know, I don't know that I'll ever do anything with that book, I think that helped me shape her character a bit more. And Anne had this background where, you know, she went to college and she had this marketing background and working in an agency and things like that. And when she got married, it was kind of expected that she was going to be a stay-at-home mom and give up that career. And I think she feels very unfulfilled, even though she acts like she, you know, she likes being a mom and she likes all the things surrounding it. She looks at her siblings and thinks, well, that could have been the life, you know, that I could have had, but she went a different path.
So one of the things that's interesting about this book is that in a lot of ways it reads like a suspense thriller, even though we're obviously not talking about espionage or somebody kidnapped the president or there's a deadly virus unleashed. I mean, it's nothing like that. I mean, in a sense, the stakes are not that high when we think of kind of the sort of the world stage, but the stakes are incredibly high for this family, for this woman, for her children, for the man who's come in to try to, you know, make all of this better. And we as we read, we genuinely do not know, where is this headed? Is this all going to explode? How can this really difficult situation possibly resolve itself? Will it resolve itself? I'm just curious, as you sat down to write this, did you know where all of this was going and what the nature of the resolution would be? Or did it sort of reveal itself in the act of writing the book?
So, no, I didn't. I, like you said, it really revealed itself to me, and that's how my writing brain works. I know a lot of people will do these super detailed outlines and character sketches and, you know, on a whiteboard plotting things out. That's not me. And I think it's fascinating because every writer approaches things in a different way. So I honestly, I had an idea that was, you know, there was going to be a mother-daughter. They were going to end up on a hoarding reality show, and I knew she was going to be obsessed with the royal family. But that's kind of it. So I just sit down and write, and things kind of reveal themselves to me as I go in the first draft. And I think in, you know, subsequent, once you're getting it out on the paper, then you can go back and, you know, kind of take a deeper look. And when you're editing, find, okay, you know, this really needs to, she needs to do something that will propel this forward, or, you know, the stakes might need to be a little higher here. And that's great when you're getting feedback to, you know, from an editor or, you know, a critique partner, that sort of thing, where they can say, okay, like for this to sell, you really need X, Y, Z. But for me, I just kind of go with it.
Hmm. Well, you've gone with it in really, really great fashion and created a really, really wonderful novel that I thoroughly enjoyed. And as I finished it, I found myself with a deeper understanding of how people can find themselves in such circumstances. And I especially felt such sympathy and understanding and affection for the character of Debbie, who we really get to know better and better through the course of this, and also her daughter Sarah, and the struggle between the two of them, and the emotional journey on which they all embark. The novel, again, is called A House Full of Windsor, published by Wyatt McKenzie, the author Kristen Contino. Kristen Contino, thank you so much for joining me today on The Morning Show, and thank you for writing such a wonderful book.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
This weekend, on the podcast version of The Morning Show, two really interesting interviews. Tomorrow, a conversation from all the way back to 1998 with the late Kurt Chalgren, who for many years was the choral director of Kids from Wisconsin. And in this 1998 conversation, We speak also with three students at the time, Kristen Singer, who now teaches for Kenosha Unified, along with Scott Weirich and Will Ray, talking about the excitement of being part of Kids from Wisconsin. That interview from the archives on tomorrow's podcast version. And on Sunday's podcast morning show from 2001, two faculty colleagues from Carthage, Chris Renault and Dan Showalter, and two students talking about a memorable trip which they took to Greece. The podcast version of the morning show